Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. It's time today for the once every 3 months treat when Peterson Toscano guest hosts Spirit in Action with material from his Citizens Climate Radio podcast. And today's material is like no other material Peterson has ever presented. Peterson is clearly a standout in so many ways. I'm not positive it's true, but I think that my interview with him back in 2007 may very well have been his introduction to radio production. And he has gone on to do so much more. His theatrical pieces, his Bible research and insights, and the several podcasts he produces. While today he will be sharing from his Citizens Climate Radio riches, you can find much more about him on his website, PetersonToscano.com, which of course is linked on NorthernSpiritRadio.org. But on to the special subject for today's show. I expect Peterson to be innovative, and he won't disappoint today as he uses a brand new, for us, approach to bringing you world vital news. Get ready for a hot mess. Over to you, Peterson.
Thank you, Mark. It is so great to be back here at Spirit in Action. About 2 years ago, I was working with a young woman who was one of the interns that was helping me with Citizens Climate Radio. We had this conversation about podcast and what kind of podcast that we like. And she's a big fan of true crime podcasts, which is no surprise. It is the most popular type of podcast that's out there. That's what most people listen to. And it seems a little weird, right, that people would get their entertainment from hearing about gory crimes. But I think why it is so popular is because it's storytelling. It's often not a straightforward storytelling, like there are twists and turns, unexpected outcomes, false leads, red herrings, you know, there's all that sort of thing. But I think it also gets to the heart of how many of us want justice. Right? We see a wrong in the world and we want there to be an accounting. And it may not even be a crime, but it's just something that's just wrong. Something that somebody said to you that was wrong, an experience you had because of a government or a store or something. And it's just part of it. You want it to be stated, this was wrong. And there be some, if not an explanation, at least an awareness of what happened. So what I thought was, what if we were to do a true crime podcast about climate change? So with my team, we put together a series, a short series, about 8 episodes that is being aired through Citizens Climate Radio. It's called Hot Mess, How Climate Consensus Turned into Political Chaos.
Welcome to Hot Mess, How Climate Consensus Turned into Political Chaos. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. In this 6-part series, we explore elements of how the united concern about global warming unraveled and stalled climate change solutions. We're especially curious about the people and moments in history that have been overlooked, stories that have been underreported. Will this be an exhaustive history of climate politics and the forces at play from the 1960s to the present? No, that would require at least 600 episodes and a staff of 50 researchers. Instead, my guests and I will reveal puzzle pieces that will surprise you. You will learn about Republican and Democratic climate heroes who deserve recognition. And we expose some of the forces behind the dreadful shift from what had been political consensus to address climate change to the tragedy of missed opportunities, along with the lies that misled countless lawmakers and the public. Through it all, you will encounter people who saw through the deception and kept their focus on the dangers that threaten humanity and life on Earth. This is a story of dangerous behavior by many, and the determination and resilience of a handful of people. The story isn't over yet. And for you listening right now, your part has yet to be told. This special series is brought to you by Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. In this first episode, we look at the very beginning of climate politics and a period of cooperation and consensus that may sound like fantasy to many listening today. In January 1977, a young congressman named Al Gore walked into the U.S. Capitol with a mission to educate his peers about the greenhouse effect and push for federal policies to combat it. But Gore, a Democrat, wasn't the first to raise the alarm. And at that time and before, it wasn't only the Democrats who took the threat of global warming seriously. In 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson was among the first U.S. leaders to be briefed on the impacts of rising carbon dioxide levels. His Science Advisory Committee issued a landmark report warning that the burning of fossil fuels was altering the atmosphere and could lead to significant global warming. Climate scientists were already alerting the president to the long-term threats posed by carbon emissions, laying the groundwork for future environmental policy. Chelsea Henderson, host of Republic EN's Ego Right Speaks podcast and author of Glacial, The Untold Story of Climate Politics, has created a platform for conservatives seeking climate change solutions. I asked Chelsea about the early history when U.S. lawmakers first became aware of the dangers posed by greenhouse gas emissions.
LBJ really embraced the first policies that were more about conservation, like let's make the land beautiful around us. And so he was really worried about this briefing. And he did what any president who was brought an issue that they didn't fully understand and didn't know how to address would do. He commissioned a report. And that report was more broad strokes about environmental conservation, but it had a 23-page chapter on carbon dioxide and the impacts of burning fossil fuels and this blanket effect that was happening with the carbon dioxide kind of making a blanket around the earth, holding our warmer air in.
For the first time, U.S. leadership was formally warned about the long-term dangers of rising carbon dioxide levels caused by burning fossil fuels. The report highlighted the emerging science of climate change, describing how carbon emissions could form a heat-trapping blanket around the Earth, causing global warming. Yet, despite these alarming findings, the immediate policy response focused more on beautification and conservation efforts, such as cleaning up highways and rivers, rather than tackling the more abstract and distant threat of climate change. Still, this early warning laid the groundwork for future environmental policies. In the early 1970s, something was in the air. No, not just city smog, but also a political will to address the causes and impacts of pollution in the air and water. Republican President Richard Nixon was instrumental in advancing environmental legislation during his presidency. In 1970, Nixon delivered a State of the Union address where he declared the environment as the defining issue of the decade. He poignantly asked, quote, "Shall we make our peace with nature and begin to make reparations for the damage we have done to our air, to our land, and to our water?" This pivotal moment set the stage for significant bipartisan efforts to tackle pollution and its effects. During Nixon's administration, several landmark pieces of environmental legislation were enacted. The National Environmental Policy Act of 1970, which required federal agencies to assess the environmental impact of their actions. The creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, in 1970 to consolidate environmental responsibilities and enforce regulations. The Clean Air Act of 1970, which mandated the EPA to establish and enforce air quality standards. By early 1972, Nixon urged lawmakers to work together to do even more. On February 8, 1972, Nixon addressed Congress about the environment.
Each of us all across this great land has a stake in maintaining and improving environmental quality, clean air and clean water, the wise use of our land, the protection of wildlife and natural beauty, parks for all to enjoy. These are part of the birthright of every American. To guarantee that birthright, we must act, and act decisively. It is literally now or never. During the past 3 years, we have made a good start. We have passed new laws to protect the environment, and we have mobilized the power of public concern. But there is much yet to be done. 18 of the major environmental proposals which I put forward a year ago has still not received final action by the Congress. I repeat today my urgent request for congressional action on this much-needed legislation. And I am also presenting a number of new proposals. The environmental agenda now before the Congress includes laws to deal with water pollution, pesticide hazards, ocean dumping, excessive noise, careless land development, and many other environmental problems. These problems will not stand still for politics or for partisanship. They demand to be met now. By meeting them now, we can make 1972 the best year ever for environmental progress. The time has come for man to make his peace with nature. Let us renew our commitment. Let us redouble our effort. The quality of our life on this good land is a cause to unite all Americans.
President Richard Nixon signed the passage of the Marine Mammal Protection Act in 1972. And the Endangered Species Act in 1973. Both of these laws are aimed at protecting wildlife and their habitats. Nixon's effort laid the foundation for modern environmental policy in the United States, showcasing that environmental protection can gain broad support across the political spectrum. Twelve years after President Lyndon B. Johnson became the first U.S. president to be briefed on the dangers of pollution from fossil fuels, another leader raised the alarm. In 1977, the newly elected congressman arrived with a singular focus on addressing the looming climate crisis. Colleagues on both sides of the aisle took the warning seriously.
The day Al Gore walked into the U.S. Capitol in January 1977, he had one mission: to use his position to educate his peers on the greenhouse effect and collaborate with them on the federal policy to stop it from getting worse. He failed to stoke any enthusiasm for the issue, but he certainly was not the last to try. Over the last 45, actually 50 years, senators, members of Congress, and even presidents on both sides of the aisle campaigned on fixing climate change, but no bill ever made it to the Oval Office for signature.
Al Gore's early efforts in the late 70s failed to immediately ignite widespread action on climate change. While the 70s were a time of growing environmental awareness, a different crisis pushed the climate discussion into the background: the oil embargo.
You know, in the 70s, or anyone that was around during the 70s, you'll remember the oil embargo, the oil crisis in America. I remember being a little kid and you could only get your gas on a certain day, depending on what the last digit of your license plate was. And so my parents had a car that was an even number and a car that was an odd number, so we could get gas any day. And I remember that being a big thing for them.
The oil crisis of the 1970s reshaped America's relationship with energy and led to a renewed focus on fossil fuel dependence. Even so, the political will for climate action began to stir, this time during the Reagan era, a time when environmental regulations were being scaled back.
Even while Reagan was trying to deregulate a lot of our environmental protections, that was kind of the hotbed of bipartisan climate action.
Despite the rollback of environmental protections under Reagan, the 1980s saw a rare moment of bipartisan interest in climate issues. Republicans and Democrats worked together to address the growing concern about pollution and energy use, laying the groundwork for future climate efforts. However, while there was interest, no comprehensive climate legislation reached the president's desk for signature during that time. Conservatives outside the USA also attempted to mobilize action that would address the growing threats from climate change. One significant figure was Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who acknowledged the dangers of climate change in her famous 1989 speech at the UN General Assembly.
"It is as menacing in its way as those more accustomed perils with which international diplomacy has concerned itself for centuries. It is the prospect of irretrievable damage to the atmosphere, to the oceans, to Earth itself. What we are now doing to the world, by degrading the land surfaces, by polluting the waters, and by adding greenhouse gases to the air at an unprecedented rate, all this is new in the experience of the Earth. It is mankind and his activities which are changing the environment of our planet in damaging and dangerous ways. Put in its bluntest form, the main threat to our environment is more and more people and their activities, the land they cultivate ever more intensively, the forests they cut down and burn, the mountainsides they lay bare, the fossil fuels they burn, the rivers and the seas they pollute. The result is that change in future is likely to be more fundamental and more widespread than anything we have known hitherto. The most pressing task which faces us at the international level is to negotiate a framework convention on climate change, a sort of good conduct guide for all nations. Fortunately, we have a model in the action already taken to protect the ozone layer. The Vienna Convention in 1985 and the Montreal Protocol in 1987 established landmarks in international law. They aim to prevent, rather than just cure, a global environmental problem. I believe we should aim to have a convention on global climate change ready by the time the World Conference on Environment and Development meets in 1992. That will be among the most important conferences the United Nations has ever held. Reason is humanity's special gift. It allows us to understand the structure of the nucleus. It enables us to explore the heavens. It helps us to conquer disease. Now we must use our reason to find a way in which we can live with nature and not dominate nature."
The concern grew through the 1990s and into the 2000s. In 2008, Al Gore's We Can Solve It initiative, launched by the Alliance for Climate Protection, brought together some unexpected pairs to highlight the bipartisan nature of the climate crisis and the need for collective action. One memorable ad featured the Reverend Al Sharpton, a liberal civil rights activist, alongside Reverend Pat Robertson, a conservative televangelist.
"I'm on the left.
And I'm usually right. And we strongly disagree.
Except on one issue. Tell them what it is, Reverend Pat."
"That would be our planet. Taking care of it is extremely important.
We all need to work together, liberals and conservatives.
So get involved. It's the right thing to do."
"Now there you go again."
Join us. Together we can solve the climate crisis. Go to wecansolveit.org.
The ads were designed to show that even those who disagree on most issues can find common ground when it comes to protecting our planet. They aired on national TV. These well-placed ads, though, did not achieve the effect the Alliance for Climate Protection hoped to see.
There was a series of ads, including an ad with Newt Gingrich and Nancy Pelosi.
"We don't always see eye to eye, do we, Newt?"
"No, but we do agree our country must take action to address climate change.
We need cleaner forms of energy, and we need them fast.
If enough of us demand action from our leaders, we can spark the innovation we need."
Go to WeCanSolveIt.org. Together, we can do this.
Now, Gingrich has rolled back his views from that. He got a lot of pushback for appearing in that piece with her, and he is now more in the climate disputer camp. But there was a period right around, or it was either right before Obama was elected or right after Obama was elected, when he did have some of these unusual partners coming out. But, you know, we're kind of getting more into the present day. The merchants of doubt, as Bob Inglis likes to call them, just continued to beat that partisan drum.
Even so, some people and groups had reason to hope that Congress would pass laws and society would make the necessary changes to transform our energy economy. Ah, but I'm getting ahead of myself. We are here to learn about the twists and turns, the doubts and lies, and the forces that undermine the united concern about climate change. A man-made storm began brewing back then, but the 1990s bipartisan cooperation began to fall apart, and a period of hostility towards even the mention of climate change started to take hold. How did this happen? Who is responsible? Who stood up against it, and even amidst the most heated debate, recognized the need to act together to address the dangers posed by a rapidly changing climate and the greenhouse gases that fueled it? Throughout this episode, you have heard commentary from Chelsea Henderson. As the host of Republic Ian's EcoRight Speaks podcast, she speaks with conservative leaders who are serious about addressing the causes of climate change. Chelsea is also the author of a new book, Glacial: The Untold Story of Climate Politics. After we chatted about the early history of climate change politics, I was curious about the bipartisan divide, even when Democrats and Republicans agree that climate change is a serious problem that needs to be addressed. Chelsea, why do you think climate change is an important issue for conservatives to address? And what do conservatives bring to the table?
When I was researching my book, Glacial, The Inside Story of Climate Politics, I was struck with how deeply rooted the climate movement is in these roots of bipartisanship. And so it really takes two sides. You don't get durable, well thought out policy when only one side is contributing. And so when you look back at the history, Richard Nixon was briefed on climate change. Gerald Ford took on the three big automakers to enact the first mandatory fuel economy standards. And he didn't do it as an environmental issue. He did it to conserve oil and sort of stick it to OPEC because we were going to get more miles on a tank of gas. And so take that. But in the end, it had great impacts on reducing tailpipe emissions. Ronald Reagan championed the Montreal Protocol, which phased out the CFCs that were thinning the ozone layer. George H.W. Bush ran in 1988 on being the greenhouse effect president. You just have this rich history of conservative lawmakers looking to be part of the solutions. That system broke down a little bit in the 90s and the early 2000s, and especially in the 2010 to 2020 period, that decade of disastrous disputation. You know, we're coming back now. We're seeing conservatives come back to the table now cautiously. There needs to be an understanding that their role is just so critical if we're going to truly solve this generational crisis.
Thank you, Chelsea, for joining us on this journey. I look forward to hear what you have to share in the next episode of Hot Mess. Learn more about Chelsea Henderson and the podcast EcoRight Speaks by visiting republicen.org. That's republicen.org. You can hear her show, The EcoRight Speaks, wherever you get podcasts. In this episode, we looked at the early days of climate awareness and moments of political unity around addressing heat-trapping greenhouse gases. Understanding the past helps us navigate the future. Even as I record this, there is news of yet more extreme weather, displacing people from their homes, putting people's lives at risk, and damage that takes billions and billions of dollars to repair. All of this could have been avoided. Imagine a different world if in 1965, lawmakers took this threat seriously and had acted. What world would we live in today? Perhaps it doesn't help to dwell on what could have been. Instead, we need to look clearly at what has happened and what we must do to make it right. Thank you for joining me on this journey. I'm Peterson Toscano, and this is Hot Mess, how climate consensus turned into political chaos.
Hot Mess is made possible through Citizens Climate Education. The show has been researched by Horace Moe, Lily Russian, and Peterson Toscano. Editorial assistance from Flannery Winchester, Ely Silvestri, and Brett Cease. Production by Peterson Toscano with assistance from Ely Silvestri. Music for this episode comes from Epidemic Sound and Ely Silvestri.
Learn how you can be part of a bipartisan effort to pass meaningful legislation that addresses fossil fuel pollution. Visit ccclusa.org/action. That's ccclusa.org/action. If you like this program and want to support the work we do, share this episode with a friend and on social media. You can also give a tax-deductible donation by visiting citizensclimateeducation.org. Together, we will make a difference.
You are listening to Spirit in Action. I'm your guest host, Peterson Toscano, and you're listening to episode 1 and 2 of Hot Mess. This is a new true crime style podcast series about climate politics in the United States. Stay tuned. There's more ahead.
We'll be back to the True Crime and Hot Mess show brought to Spirit in Action today by Peterson Toscano and Citizens Climate Radio. But maybe I'd better remind you that our website is northernspiritradio.org, and we are now halfway through our 20th year of bringing you our shows, both Spirit in Action and Song of the Soul. They're all available on northernspiritradio.org, including the list of the 35 or so community radio stations that carry our programs. And you can also find the sites that host our podcasts and much, much more. Go ahead and make our day by posting a comment for this and for other shows, because we always love hearing from you. Life is so much better in community, so let's make the connection. We, of course, need your support to sustain a long-term effort like this, so consider donating to Northern Spirit Radio. Keep in mind that a major influence on public opinion in the USA is the media that folks are exposed to, and about 90% of media are controlled by just 6 corporations. When you empower us, you're providing an alternative voice and story, one that lifts up world healers instead of manipulating you for a buck. Your support is important, so please help us out, and please lend a hand to your local community radio station. In any case, we'll go back now to Citizens Climate Radio, Peterson Toscano. Make it hot, Peterson.
Welcome to Hot Mess, how climate consensus turned into political chaos. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. In this 6-part series, we explore elements of how the united concern about global warming unraveled and stalled climate change solutions. The trend from the 1970s revealed that individuals in both parties recognized the need to stop pollution before it did any more damage. For many of their colleagues, though, pollution was not top of mind. There were no clear solutions for both parties to embrace. Groups of people needed to demonstrate to lawmakers that citizens cared about these issues. They also had to find an inspiring solution that would capture the attention of individuals who together could advocate for meaningful change. Meet Marshall Saunders. He first became concerned about climate change in 2006. A year later, he founded Citizens Climate Lobby. Since that time, CCL has grown in numbers and influence, with nearly 250 volunteers and 400 chapters in the USA alone. They meet members of Congress. They engage the public through the media. They regularly facilitate respectful and thoughtful conversations about climate solutions. Marshall Saunders created a culture of caring and respect for others and responsibility for how we live on the planet.
Like, I wasn't a mean green activist or anything like that. I was in business, forget a six. I was in shopping center construction and building and paving over the land.
Yes. He literally paved paradise and put in a parking lot. He was that guy. Marshall Saunders hailed from a conservative family of entrepreneurs in Texas. On the outside, he looked like a confident, successful businessman. But inside, he felt isolated, afraid, and angry.
I pulled myself away from other people to be separate. And I summed it up as separate and superior. That was my way of going through life. I would essentially have afraid of people. It starts with fear and separateness, but it can proceed to, even to hatred.
But then, through a series of events, Marshall Saunders had a major breakthrough. He became engaged in the world around him and grew sensitive to the sufferings of others.
A friend invited me to go to a workshop on personal growth. I went to this thing. I thought, what am I doing here? I didn't see all these people needing me here, but what am I doing here? And the guy who was leading it says, we don't get many people like you here. How did you get here? I said, I walked out that night. I said, I'm not coming back. I'm not coming back tomorrow. It's a 3-day workshop. There were two young ladies who pleaded with me in such a way that there's something here for you. And I thought, well, okay, I'll give it another day.
And he stuck it out. He became engaged in the world around him and grew sensitive to the sufferings of others. He then used his business savvy to assist people harmed by hunger and poverty. He joined an organization called Results. They used an innovative approach to address hunger in the world. They called on and trained volunteer advocates who successfully lobbied lawmakers and world leaders. Marshall volunteered with Results. Then, something unexpected happened. Marshall Saunders became alarmed by climate change.
Well, the first thing I remember, there was an article, and it said that in 5 years, everybody is going to be talking about climate change. And I thought, I think that's right. It just felt like in myself it was right. I didn't say anything out loud. When the movie An Inconvenient Truth came out, I went to see it. And I thought, holy socks, I had no idea how much trouble we'd gotten ourselves into.
Marshall Saunders went on to create Citizens Climate Lobby, and with a handful of dedicated volunteers and a tiny staff, they presented a solution to members of Congress: carbon fee and dividend. Their plan to address greenhouse gas pollution was simple and elegant, and it had something for lawmakers on the right, left, and center. Marshall Saunders and the Citizens Climate Lobby volunteers argued that fossil fuel extraction did not consider the external costs that racked up in the form of harm to people on the planet. They proposed to place a fee on each ton of carbon that extractors take out of the ground. Each year, that fee would increase. But what about citizens, who would bear the brunt of these costs as the prices of petroleum and coal increased? That is where the dividend comes in. The money collected through the fee did not need to fund the government. Instead, that money could be refunded to citizens to help with the rising energy cost and products affected by those costs. The carbon fee and dividend would use market forces to transform the energy economy, drive innovation, and protect people and families throughout the transition. Since the very beginnings of CCL in 2007, volunteer members have directly lobbied their members of Congress and every congressional district in the USA, write a multitude of letters to the editor in their local papers, train thousands of other volunteers, and inspire lawmakers to introduce legislation like the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. Before his death in 2019, I asked Marshall Saunders about these successes, his personal breakthrough, and his extraordinary ability to motivate hundreds of thousands of CCL volunteers. What secret did he and others discover that moved the needle for so many people?
Well, we trust that you are magnificent. It is trusting that ordinary people can get the job done. It's a trusting in ordinary people. You know, not people who have made it, not people who are powerful, but ordinary people. You know, and if people are not demonstrating that, well, they can't. They can't. They need a little encouragement, a little breakthrough, like I am. So, you know, it's one step at a time. One step at a time.
Throughout this episode, you have heard commentary from Chelsea Henderson. As the host of Republic Ian's EcoRight Speaks podcast, she speaks with conservative leaders who are serious about addressing the causes of climate change. Chelsea is also the author of a new book, Glacial, The Untold Story of Climate Politics. Chelsea, how do conservatives and progressives differ in their approach to discussing climate change, both in terms of the urgency of the issue and the solutions they propose?
I think that the way conservatives and liberals talk about climate change differently is both comes in the presentation of how urgent the problem is, but also in the solutions. And so, you know, nobody wants to be talked down to. Nobody wants to be told, this is the solution, take it and run. I mean, maybe some people do. We'll get back to that another episode. But so when you have, you know, the politics has been lopsided for the last 20 years. So you have had the more kind of left of center folks driving the progress. And I can see why there would be some resentment on the other side, especially when those solutions might not align with the values on the right. But honestly, you know, the right did take themselves out of the game. And so now they're having to play that catch up. As Congressman John Curtis likes to say, you have to be at the table or you're on the menu. And I think there's a big recognition of that now. And while older generations of conservatives don't like to fear that there is alarmism in talking about the urgency to solve climate change, the younger generation doesn't seem to embrace that. The younger generation sees that it's urgent. They're going to be around another 80 years, right? And they want to make sure that they're living in a sustainable climate.
Thank you, Chelsea, for joining us on this journey. I look forward to hear what you have to share in the next episode of Hot Mess. Learn more about Chelsea Henderson and the podcast EcoRight Speaks by visiting republicen.org. That's republicen.org. You can hear her show, The EcoRight Speaks, wherever you get podcasts. In our next episode, we'll delve into the dangerous shift in climate politics and the rise of climate denial and opposition to climate-related legislation.
Exxon oil executives, and particularly their scientists, knew about the devastating effects of climate change decades before that science was ever really made public. And they saw, okay, well, if we're the ones doing this, if the fossil fuel industry is the one that's quite literally putting the planet in a microwave, we need to make sure for the sake of our jobs and our business's success, that this doesn't reach the general public.
Thank you for joining me on this journey. I'm Peterson Toscano, and this is Hot Mess, how climate consensus turned into political chaos.
Hot Mess is made possible through Citizens Climate Education. The show has been researched by Horace Moe, Lily Russian, and Peterson Toscano. Editorial assistance from Flannery Winchester, Ely Silvestri, and Brett Cease. Production by Peterson Toscano with assistance from Ely Silvestri. Music for this episode comes from Epidemic Sound and Ely Silvestri.
Hot Mess is made possible through Citizens Climate Education. Learn how you can be part of a bipartisan effort to pass meaningful legislation that addresses fossil fuel pollution. Visit ccclusa.org/action. That's ccclusa.org/action. If you like this program and want to support the work we do, share this episode with a friend and on social media. You can also give a tax-deductible donation by visiting citizensclimateeducation.org. Together, we will make a difference. Welcome to Hot Mess, how climate consensus turned into political chaos. We explore how the united concern about global warming unraveled and stalled climate change solutions. This special series is brought to you by Citizens Climate Radio. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. In our first two episodes, we explored the early bipartisan efforts to address climate change and the emergence of the Citizens Climate Volunteer Movement. Today, we pull back the curtain to reveal pivotal moments, people, and institutions that initiated a terrible shift away from climate concern to skepticism and inaction. By the early 1990s, the momentum for climate action was growing, but so was the opposition. Fossil fuel interests, political strategies, and cultural influences changed the tide. One of the first significant setbacks came from disinformation campaigns. Funded by fossil fuel interests and companies, these campaigns aimed to cast doubt on the science of climate change and slow down any potential legislation. Joining us once again is Chelsea Henderson. Chelsea is the director of editorial content at Republic EN, a conservative group focused on climate solutions. With over 25 years in federal climate policy, Chelsea's career spans roles on and off Capitol Hill. She also hosts the EcoRight Speaks podcast and shares climate news in her Week in Review e-newsletter. Recently, Chelsea published Glacial, the Inside Story of Climate Politics. It's a deep dive into the challenges of crafting climate policy in Washington. Chelsea, how did the shift away from climate change consensus to political contention happen?
This is such an easy question. Basically, the fossil fuel industry had one very simple playbook that they've been employing since the early 90s. Cast doubt on the science and stoke fear that energy prices will increase. And backed with the millions of dollars into ad campaigns focused on those two messages, they actually haven't really needed to evolve their campaigns over time. They've stoked the fear that we don't know exactly how to solve climate change, or maybe that the science isn't exactly right. They've had a very, very effective playbook that they haven't had to update.
The seeds of doubt were planted, and over the next few decades, they flourished, creating a deeply polarized political landscape. Joining Chelsea is Katie Zarkreski, one of the hosts of Green Tea Party Radio.
Katie is a communications professional and environmental advocate dedicated to integrating faith and environmental stewardship. As communications manager at the Catholic Climate Covenant, she utilizes her background in advocacy and communications to promote the organization's mission of caring for creation. Her personal journey from climate skepticism to environmental activism underscores her commitment to addressing climate change's impact on vulnerable communities. Katie co-hosts Green Tea Party Radio, a podcast that approaches environmental issues from a conservative perspective. Alongside co-host Hannah Rogers and Zach Torpy, Katie explores conservative approaches to climate action, emphasizing that environmental conservation aligns with their conservative values. Katie holds a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and anthropology from the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and a master's degree in public service from the Clinton School of Public Service. Her diverse educational background and personal experiences inform her work, enabling her to engage effectively with various audiences on the importance of environmental stewardship. Katie, welcome to the show. Tell me, what were some of the most effective tactics used by disinformation campaigns to sow doubt about climate science?
So Peterson, the fossil fuel industry has been using really pivotal means of spreading misinformation all the way back to the late 1950s. You might remember here a couple of years ago, there was this groundbreaking story that came out about how Exxon oil executives, and particularly their scientists, knew about the devastating effects of climate change decades before that science was ever really made public. And they saw, okay, well, if we're the ones doing this, if the fossil fuel industry is the one that's quite literally putting the planet in a microwave, we need to make sure, for the sake of our jobs and our business and our business's success, that this doesn't reach the general public. And so many scientists at Exxon ended up burying a lot of this research. And a lot of other fossil fuel industries started to follow suit as well. I mean, GM, Ford Motor Companies, Total Oil Company. These were just a few, all the way from the late 1950s all the way through the 60s and 70s, that their scientists saw, okay, there's clearly a correlation between what we're doing as fossil fuel industries and a heating planet on a level that we've never seen before, ever. And for the sake of being able to be profitable as a company, we can't let it get out that we're quite literally destroying the planet. So a lot of these different fossil fuel companies ended up taking out ads and publications and newspapers. It really subliminally promoted their business. They buried all this information, and they continued to double down on a lot of their efforts. Soon, so many of these fossil fuel industries had their slimy and oily little tentacles wrapped all around the most pivotal parts of the American economy and the global industry that people were scared to defy them. I mean, you've got Exxon investing over $1 million in tanker projects that are aimed at, you know, studying greenhouse gas effects and things of that nature, getting the results that they get and then burying it. It's almost like they're double, triple, and quadruple checking that what they're doing is having the impact that they think it is. They're seeing, oh my gosh, yes, it is. Quickly, we have to bury it. And so when that article broke here several years ago, a lot of people were like, wow, we could have been doing something about this for 50, 60, 70 years, but these wealthy companies didn't want to jeopardize their bottom line, and now the planet's on fire.
As these disinformation campaigns took hold, the political landscape began to shift. The mid-1990s saw a dramatic change with the Republican Revolution and the rise of more conservative forces within the party. This period marked the beginning of a deeper partisan divide on environmental issues.
The partisan machinations of Washington, D.C. in the early 90s started to kick in, especially after Clinton and Gore were elected in 1992. And then by 1994, you had the Republican Revolution, where Republicans took both chambers of Congress for the first time since the 1950s. There was a very strong sentiment at that time that priority needed to be on rolling back regulations, not putting new regulations on the books. And that was when the partisanship really started to take root.
As public trust in climate science waned, political will to address the issue weakened. The fossil fuel industry wasn't alone in this effort. Other influential groups like the Koch brothers and ALEC used their resources to sway politicians and shape policy.
I mean, really money talks, right? And with Koch Industries, which is the second largest privately held company in the country, they own a number of oil refineries and pipelines. So they also market crude oil and coal and chemicals, and they have annual revenues of $115 billion. They are also one of the top 25 U.S. corporate water and carbon polluters. So if you take their money plus their level of pollution, and then with those profits, they're spending about $150 million a year funding a network of 90 think tanks and advocacy groups, that time period from the Kyoto Protocol in 1997 through the last reporting in 2018. They've used that money to disparage climate science, to do what I, you know, to do that, casting that doubt of climate science, and to block efforts to address climate change, a lot through political donations. And in the process, they've really conned millions of people into believing that they themselves, the polluters, should not be held accountable for their pollution. When everyday Americans, as part of our local taxes, we pay, right? We pay for our garbage pickup. We pay if we have to take something to the dump. The Koch brothers don't pay for the pollution that they make. With an organization like ALEC, which works at the state level and provides templates, legislative templates, you know, and on a variety of issues, not just climate change, it really becomes a one size fits all. So you might have multiple states that are taking a template from ALEC and enacting it. Even if you're a state that is a heavy fossil fuel state or a manufacturing state, and you're not quite there to enact something on climate change, the idea that we're just going to take these cookie cutter approaches doesn't really work for anyone except for ALEC, who is then flexing their political strength. You know, these are climate movements that are really rooted in wanting to maintain profits, not be held accountable for pollution, and controlling the narrative, and they've been highly successful.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Spirit in Action. I'm Peterson Toscano. You've been listening to Hot Mess, How Climate Consensus Led to Political Chaos. It is a special series offered through Citizens Climate Radio. You can find Citizens Climate Radio wherever you listen to podcasts, or just go to Google and type in Citizens Climate Radio and you will find us. We have over 100 episodes with all kinds of people from all sorts of backgrounds. It's probably the most diverse set of guests and topics you'll ever find about climate change. You know, we're honest, but we're hopeful. I also produce other shows like Climate Changed through the BTS Center. I'm the host of Quakers Today podcast. But my big passion in life and my huge curiosity is around climate change. And if this is something that you're curious about too, and you want to know more, you want to get involved more, you have a story to share, please contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can find Citizens Climate Radio by searching for it, or you can go to cclusa.org/radio. And with that, I hand it back to Mark Helpsmeet. Thank you so much, Mark, for letting me guest host Spirit in Action today.
You're very welcome, Peterson. I know our listeners are better off for hearing from you. I'll remind you all that, in addition to the links Peterson gave you, you can also check out his website, PetersonToscano.com. And I've obviously got the link to his site and to the guests he featured and to Citizens Climate Radio, all of them on NorthernSpiritRadio.org. He'll be back in February to share some more CCR. But in the meantime, keep building community and moving the world toward healing. And we'll see you next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every song, we will move this world along, and our hope.